When Senate President Andy Biggs moved closer to Governor Jan Brewer's budget proposal last week, especially when it comes to funding for child protective services, many presumed that a final deal was close. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll get the latest on budget talks at the Capitol and find out why progress has stalled. Plus, 13 years ago today, police officer Jason Schechterly was involved in a horrific car crash. But after countless surgeries and therapy sessions, Schechterly is somehow still going strong. He and author Landon J. Napoleon chronicle his long recovery in the new book, Burning Shield. Also, La Panza can mean many things to Latin women. I'll talk with Virginia Grice about her performance piece, The Panza Monologues, and a Phoenix landmark, Karsh's Bakery, closes its doors for the last time tonight. We'll remember it with longtime Phoenician Bill Strauss. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, former Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly would be in studio to talk about his long road to recovery from a horrific auto accident that left him with severe burns. A new book by Schechterly and Landon J. Napoleon, Burning Shield, was published earlier this month. Also, the centerpiece of the lives of Latin women is The Panza. I'll talk with Virginia Grice, who is in the Valley with her performance piece, The Panza Monologues. And National Geographic photographer and filmmaker Brian Smith has been to many exotic locales. He's also been on the hunt for the so-called monster fish. He'll join me later. We start today's program wondering what's holding up the State House's passage of a budget for the next fiscal year. Last week, along party lines, the Senate moved a budget through. That had many people anticipating the House would do the same. A vote was supposed to happen on Monday, but it was put off until Tuesday when, again, there was not a vote. State Representative John Kavanaugh of Fountain Hills is the House Appropriations Chair and joins me now. Representative Kavanaugh, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So did you anticipate a full vote of the House on Monday or Tuesday?
Yes, we were optimistic that we would have the 31 votes, but unfortunately, towards the end, we found ourselves a vote or two shy. So we regrouped. We've been talking with different interested parties, and by parties, I mean legislators or groups of legislators, an attempt to wring out that extra vote or two. In fact, I just hopped out of a meeting now where we're getting input from members, small groups of members. But there's a possibility we may have a budget we can vote out of the House this evening, hopefully.
What are the obstacles right now?
Well, the obstacles are 31, 16, and 1. You have to have 31 representatives, which is a majority of the House, 16 senators, and one governor. And it's kind of like whack-a-mole trying to get everybody together or herding cats because, you know, if you make one concession to one member or a small group that need an item, you risk having another member or group of members who despise that item saying, I'm now off the budget. So it's quite a daunting task to get something everybody can agree with. Most people agree with the budget overall, but have to hold their nose on several line items. It's complicated.
Is that a sign? I know you've been in the legislature post things like term limits that people will bring up or clean elections. Is that something that would not have been the case, let's say, in the past? Is there a feeling that people have? Maybe they're more one-issue folks, so they're people who really have something in mind as opposed to what the overall caucus might want.
Well, you know, things like clean elections and redistricting, which create, redistricting obviously creates, and the Civil Rights Act, the Federal Civil Rights Act, this creates districts that have to be overwhelmingly Democrat to guarantee minority representation, which obviously on the other side of the coin creates districts that are overwhelmingly Republican. So you have people that are much more ideological. You then have things like redistricting, which furthers that. You have clean elections funding, which lets candidates who are further out on both sides of the ideological spectrum get elected because they just have to get some $5 contributions instead of trying to market themselves with donors. So all of those things create an interesting matchup of people, you know, very ideologically entrenched in their beliefs. And, getting them together is a lot more difficult. But it's probably better than the olden days when most of the big donations were controlled by the legislative leaders who doled them out to members. And if you didn't go along with the small deals that they crafted among themselves, you didn't get donation money next time and you weren't back in the legislature. So it's more complicated but more democratic today.
Okay, let's come back to the fact that you hopped out of a meeting. It's hard for me to picture you hopping. I hope you're not offended by that, but I hope you didn't literally hop.
At this stage, I literally crawled out. But.
Okay. When we're talking about a $9 billion budget, I'm not going to say $20 million is a drop in the bucket, but is there a feeling that $20 million, if it involves extra money for child protective services, which everyone seems to think we need, does it make sense that would hold up a budget like this?
Well, no, and those things aren't necessarily holding up the budget.
Okay.
I mean, it can be a small item that's $6 million that a member has a grave philosophical opposition to. And then you hope that you can convince the member that, if you're off, then, we'll have to do more concessions on the other side of the ideological spectrum to get additional votes there, and the end budget will be worse than what you have in front of you.
What are the chances you think something will be solved, and something will be solved where their changes are not dramatic enough that Governor Brewer is going to sign it?
Well, we don't directly communicate with the Senate and the governor as we negotiate. It's not a coordinated effort like that. But we do know roughly where the different chambers are and what their limits are, and we try to, as we craft our budget, we try to intuitively make it something that we know will not fail in the other chamber or be vetoed by the governor. But again, it's more a sense of knowing where they generally are at than actually saying, if we put this in, will you veto it, Governor? It's not coordinated like that.
Finally, you mentioned the whack-a-mole idea. Is this a situation where, is there true arm twisting going on here, or is it a lot softer than that?
The only arm twisting is members on leadership. This is not the kind of a government nowadays like the old days where leadership has this tremendous control over members in terms of assignments and donations. That's not the way it works. I mean, members have a real voice. Members own their vote, and we had to convince them to give us their vote. This is not, Chicago and, in the 1960s. The one thing that most people should know is that their representatives are pretty much free agents, and we have to sell them on the budget.
Republican State Representative John Kavanaugh, the House Appropriations Chair. Representative, thanks.
Okay, my pleasure.
And now for more on the state budget, we turn to the Arizona Capital Times, Jim Small. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. How much of this falls on leadership? How much of this falls on the fact that there are individual members who want particular things?
Some of both. I mean, the decision on Monday to forge ahead with a budget vote, or at least try to have a budget vote Monday night, was a decision made by leadership, even though it was clear to pretty much everyone watching that there were there was a very good chance that the votes wouldn't be there. Leadership did quickly realize, I think, that that was going to be the case, and so they halted the vote. But at the same time, hearing Representative Kavanaugh talk about the idea that these members are free agents, I mean, there is a lot of that. It is incumbent upon leadership to go out there and convince the members that the budget that they've put together is a good one and is one that they should support. And even at that point, it kind of doubles back onto leadership again, because it is their responsibility to cobble together the 31 votes, however they do it.
Jim, come down to specifics a little bit. How much of this does have to do with Representative Kavanaugh mentioned something else, but it seems like the biggest part of funding has to do with CPS. There's also some Common Core stuff in there. Give us some details on what's holding this up.
Yeah, there seem to be a couple of main areas. I think the main areas really are the CPS funding. I mean, the idea of how much the state should put in its budget right now for the new Division of Child Safety and Family Services that the governor has created to replace CPS in the Department of Economic Security. The Senate had a fairly low number in there. They increased it a little bit. I think it's about $13 million or $15 million right now. The governor's budget initially requested $25 million, and that's where you're seeing some of these moderate Republicans in the House are what they're pushing for. One of the other really big issues, and it's a real strong point of contention between the Senate and between this group of House Republicans, has to deal with district-sponsored charter schools. And the idea that essentially you have you had 3 or 4 years of deep cuts to state to K-12 education, and so one of the ways that some of the districts have found to try to cope with this is to go out and turn some of their existing schools into charter schools, which allows them to collect a little bit more money, about $1,000 more per student. They can use that money then to create new programs, to create special programs to these charter schools, but the benefit of the of doing that is that the charter schools still get access to the property tax base that the rest of the district does, something that a normal, you know, a privately owned charter school doesn't have access to. In fact, they're specifically forbidden from having that kind of access in state law. So the Senate budget proposes ending that program, not just ending it now, but ending it all the way back to July of 2013. And there were 50-some-odd schools that were created district schools that were turned into charter schools. They would basically undo that and take that money away from those school districts. And the Republicans in the House who oppose that say that this is really, you know, an important thing for these districts to be able to do. They are doing what the legislature asked. They're creating programs, you know, STEM programs and career and technical ed programs and things like that that the legislature has directed them to do. And because the legislature hasn't properly funded them, they're having to go this route, which is perfectly legal and has been since the mid-1990s when charter schools were created.
Hmm. Jim, are we going to see any Democratic involvement in this, even to, like we saw with Medicaid in the last session, this idea that some Democrats would team up with some of the Republicans? Or are we to the point where stuff is close enough on this budget that the Republicans will come together and the governor will sign it?
Right now, it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to get involved. I know the Democrats are certainly open to it, and they're willing to work along with the governor's office and some of these Republicans. But right now, it looks like, you know, they've sent a signal out there, but it hasn't been returned yet. I talked to one House Republican who said, no, we can't work with the Democrats. This has to be a Republican budget, and that means it's incumbent on Andy Tobin and Andy Biggs to go out there and first reach a deal with us and then go out there and find the votes needed to pass it, because we're not going to turn to the Democrats this time.
Jim, finally, based on what you're seeing and hearing, should there be a budget vote by the House today?
I wouldn't expect it. They'll be coming back to the floor this afternoon, but it doesn't sound like they're going to be ready yet to go on a budget vote. I think the hope is that maybe by the end of the week, maybe tomorrow they can. But from what we understand, the Senate is right now preparing its kind of counter proposal to what the House moderate Republicans have proposed, and my guess is it won't. It probably won't pass muster today. Maybe it'll move the needle a little bit closer, and then the two sides will come together a little bit more. But I think we're probably still several days off, if not, you know, maybe next week sometime.
Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times. You can follow him on Twitter at Jim Small. Jim, thanks.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The very popular Echo Canyon Trail at Camelback Mountain closed for nearly a year for upgrades and renovations. Since reopening, though, even more hikers and outdoor enthusiasts have decided to try the trail. That's led to increased congestion and jammed parking lots. With me for a few minutes to talk about it is Cynthia Brown, Park Supervisor for Phoenix Parks and Recreation. Cynthia, has the redo overall been a success?
Well, I definitely think that the redesign was a great idea. It has been a success. We didn't have enough parking before, and we've nearly doubled it. We didn't have permanent restroom facilities, and now we have restrooms. We have chilled water fountains. We have safety signage, and we have shade. We have a Ramada area. We have a guardhouse. So definitely the redesign was a success. The challenge has been that now that it's been renovated, we have drawn more visitors. People want to go and visit the area and see what the new changes are like. And people who didn't visit the area previously are curious. It's been in the news. It's been in the It's been in magazines, it's in the paper. It's like, I want to go there. We never went there before. You know, what's going on in Camelback Mountain?
Well, so what do you make of the backlash from some people saying, okay, there are more spaces, they're not enough? Is that a situation where it would have been impossible to plan ahead, or if people hear about a new thing, hey, we all want to try it now.
Yeah. You know, honestly, we feel that we could never have enough parking. And so adding more parking, you know, has we have improved the parking lot, and now we can handle more of new visitors, but the old visitors that used to come every day, you know, the locals that live in the neighborhood that used to just come and run up the mountain and, you know, and run down, are now running into the out-of-towners, the newcomers, the locals. It's just drawn more people, and we don't have enough room for everyone to come in the first 4 hours of opening. Now, you know, spread it out during the day. There's lesser traffic in the late afternoon and the evenings, but in that first part of the day, everyone wants to get their hike in while the weather's cool, and that's the challenge.
We're not that far away from the summer when a lot of folks, first of all, you're going to have maybe even more compressed time when people are going out, but there'll also be, one would think, fewer people because we'll have fewer out-of-town visitors then. Could that make it a little bit easier? Can that ease a transition a bit?
Oh, definitely. When it starts getting hot, you know, only those true dedicated hikers are coming out at, you know, 90 degrees, 100 degrees, and, you know, going up and down. The out-of-towners are not in town. They're actually out. And so our summer numbers are greatly reduced. And we think that summer will bring a lot of relief to that trail and to the area. And we should see traffic get back to normal in the summer months.
Cynthia Brown is Park Supervisor for Phoenix Parks and Recreation. Cynthia, thanks for the time.
Alrighty.
Coming up next on Here and Now, we'll talk with former Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly about his recovery from the terrible auto accident that happened 13 years ago today. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. The XV Crosstrek Hybrid, the first hybrid from Subaru, has arrived. You can see it now at shopsubaru.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. BBC News Hour comes your way at 1. Is your car always in for repairs? Is it ready to kick the bucket any day? When it's time to get a new car to get you where you need to go, donate your old ride to the programs you love on KJZZ. We'll send you a tax receipt and we'll tow it away for free. It's easy. Go to cars.kjzz.org. Checking temperatures around the state right now, cloudy and 50 degrees at the Grand Canyon. It's partly sunny and 47 in Flagstaff, sunny and 75 degrees in Tucson, partly cloudy and 69 in Yuma. Right now, under partly sunny skies, it's 78 degrees in Phoenix at 11:23.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. 13 years ago today, Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly's Ford Crown Victoria patrol car was rear-ended by a taxi and burst into flames. He was trapped in the car for 8 minutes and left with severe burns, and after more than 50 surgeries, he's still recovering. Jason and his co-author Landon J. Napoleon recount the story in the book Burning Shield. They'll be talking about the book and signing copies Friday night at 7 at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe, and they join me now in studio. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve, for having us.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Jason, I think people want to know how you're feeling physically and mentally right now.
Physically, I'm feeling great, as healthy and as can be. I haven't experienced pain in a great number of years, very, very healthy. And mentally, couldn't be better. I love every part of my life. I look forward to every day, and I'm a better person for everything that I've gone through.
How long did it take to get to that point? We're talking 13 years after the accident. So even as an optimistic guy, how long did it take you to get to that point?
I'd say the toughest part was the first year, the first 12 months, and it's interesting that today is the anniversary, and 13 years, I don't think much of it. It's just kind of another day, but that first anniversary was the interesting little box that I had to get out of, and when I woke up March 27th of 2002, made great strides after that. So that was the mental part. Going back to work, having another child, there's been a lot of big moments in my life and my journey that have kept me moving forward.
Are those the biggest moments? Talking about getting back to work, having another child, having your family support you like that?
Yeah, it's been incredible. I mean, the family support, the friend support. I was very blessed that I had a job that was covered in the media and gave the public a chance. You know, we live in a great community. I really can't imagine had this happened anywhere else in the country. The Valley here is kind of like being in a small town, and this support and love that I felt has been tremendous. So all those things, and then, yeah, going back to work, I mean, I loved my job, and I wanted to get back. It took me 18 months, but I did get back, and that helped a lot in my recovery.
You've obviously changed physically.
Yes.
How much have you changed mentally and emotionally? Are you a stronger person, a better person?
I think I'm a stronger person emotionally. I think I enjoy humor a lot more. I like to not take things too seriously. And more, the strength comes more from understanding and appreciating adversity. This, you know, my overall story, when you really look at it, when you really read this book, the fact that I was a police officer and the fact that I was burned and disfigured, those are the two least important parts of this. We all face adversity, and it's been 13 years. That's old news for me.
Okay.
Now I'm going through what everybody goes through on a daily basis. And so I'm hopeful when people read the book, they will understand how they can get through their own.
You are the epitome of the example of the phrase, putting things in perspective, because people get up, oh, my back hurts, oh, my stomach hurts. And then here you are all these years later, you know, because a lot of people might have just curled up into a ball. So what were some of the things that kept you strong going through all this?
Family, being a father is, there's nothing like it, and you don't want to take that for granted or be willing to give that up. I was very lucky. Never once did I wish that I didn't survive that accident. It would have been a lot easier to not have survived versus what I was facing, but I was always very thankful and very blessed. You know, the work that the firefighters did that night, the doctors, you got to give them all the credit in the world. I'm not where I'm at today because of me. Every piece of the puzzle was in place for me to be supported and to be able to survive this.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Jason Schechterle and Landon J. Napoleon. The new book is called Burning Shield. Landon, how did you guys get together on this? And how much research went into what happened, but also how do you gain Jason's trust? How long did that take? I mean, a subject sometimes is eager to tell the story, sometimes they're not.
Jason and I have a mutual friend, Pat McGroder, a local plaintiff's attorney. And Pat actually represented Jason in his case against Ford. And I've known Pat for probably a decade now. And I knew of Jason, I knew of his story. But surprisingly, over these last 9 years, I'd never met him. And for whatever reason, it finally came together about 15 months ago. Pat said, hey, Jason wants to do this book. And I said, great, let's set up a meeting. So the three of us met. And for me, probably after 45 seconds or so, something clicked. And I said, I absolutely have to write this story. Mm. And I don't know what that was or why that was. And, you know, as far as getting comfortable, I think Jason had kind of a similar kind of immediate response that, oh, yeah, I think this is going to work. And so we just dived in, and most of my initial, well, all of my initial interviews were with Jason. Okay. Spent many, many, many hours primarily at his house. He makes a good cup of coffee. And we just went through the whole thing, and then he put me in touch with his police contacts, doctors, legal. That's one of the things that's so fascinating about this book is there's so many different timelines and storylines that interweave together. And this is the 14th book I've written. And it's been one of those projects that's just had that magic pixie dust.
Now, Jason's being humble. What's the most amazing thing that you've discovered about spending all this time with him and about reliving the story of what happened, not just 13 years ago, but what happened with all the surgeries and all the stuff that he had to go through? What amazes you most about what he's been through?
He mentioned his sense of humor. And I think sometimes people are hesitant when they're around Jason. They're not quite sure what they can or can't say, and they're very respectful and treat things delicately. But I think sense of humor really stands out. And just one thing to share, and this is in the book, but he would joke with family and friends and say, hey, maybe I could get a job for a cigarette company. I could do an ad about the dangers of smoking in bed. And to be able to make light of what he's gone through, I think really speaks to who he is and what's helped him get through this.
Jason, I don't want to belabor this, but we talked about your spirit inside, your sense of humor, but also in the book there's mention of the fact that, you know, you do the motivational speaking, but you don't talk to young kids, you don't take the family to Disneyland. I mean, you're strong, but is that hurtful in any way, this idea that people looking at the outside as opposed to how you've grown on the inside?
It's not so much hurtful. I try to respect other people's feelings. This is, my appearance is not something you see every day, and I do believe that it can be disruptive, especially to children. That coupled with, I put myself out there, and I love to do the motivational speaking, and I travel. I'm in strange airports all the time, but I still live in a somewhat protective bubble. I only go grocery shopping at the same store every time. I go to the same places for lunch or dinner when I go out. So it's my own, you know, I know what brings me anxiety and stress, and I'm in touch with that, and I'm okay with that. It's part of my permanent adversity is my appearance. I'm always going to deal with that. So I protect myself in the ways that I need to, but especially with kids, you just have to respect that they've got young minds and they're resilient. They get over it, especially when you can talk to them. But I usually don't talk to kids in a formal group setting under seventh grade.
You wanted to be a police officer. I mean, you really wanted to be a police officer and went through a lot of effort to get it.
Yes.
Were you hit hard by the irony when you couldn't do it for a while because of this freak accident, and then you worked so hard to get back to it? Did you feel gypped at first?
I never felt gypped. I was sad. I was disappointed. And even through today, when I see some of my closest friends or guys that I went to the academy with, and I see where they're at in their career, it's sometimes fun to daydream, but it's hard to explain, but I really would not change anything about where I'm at. I believe there's some very good reasons of why the events of March 26, 2001 took place, and I'm completely okay with those reasons. And, you know, if it wasn't for this, I don't think my youngest son would have the life he has. And I'm going to coach his baseball game today. And to make those memories, to see his little face and think, yeah, it's all completely worth it. Perspective is an easy thing when you're dealing with emotions of fatherhood or things like that. So no, I don't feel gypped.
And the concept of destiny is really ever present in this book. Is that a theme you guys both hit on together?
Yes. Landon, this has been a very sensitive, intimate journey for me to get this story out there. In some ways, you know, I want to pay it forward. I want other people to benefit with overcoming their adversity. But if this book never sells a copy, it's a legacy for my kids, and I'm incredibly proud. Landon was definitely the right person to tell this. The way he wrote this has been incredible for me. I've laughed, I've cried, I've relived things that I had forgotten. And he came up with kind of the themes about how we're going to tie in what's happened to other police officers across the country with these rear and fuel fed fires, and how he portrayed my work to become a police officer, and how I view family and friends and life in general. It's captured in these pages. I give him all the credit in the world. He did that.
Landon, did you laugh and cry when you were writing it?
I still laugh and cry. Jason and I were just in Baltimore about a week ago, and I listened to him speak, and I still get teary. Even sitting here listening to him, and when you asked him the question, did you feel gypped, I keep thinking, wait, you had to feel gypped, and you had to feel self-pity. And he's got some amazing gene that I think not a lot of people have.
Has it changed your perspective on life?
Yeah, it has. And when you talked about you wake up and all my back hurts and my internet's not buffering fast enough, and you say, wait a minute, those things don't matter. Absolutely.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with Jason Schechterle and Landon J. Napoleon. Their new book is Burning Shield. You can see them Friday night at 7 at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe. Jason, let's talk a little bit more about your family, if you don't mind.
Okay.
When you get married to someone, you have certain expectations. Obviously, you had a family.
Yes.
How did it change, if at all, your relationship with your wife when you go from being partner, lover, and then in many ways she was a caregiver for a while?
Yes, for a very long time. I mean, I needed, when I was in the hospital for 5 months, and when I come home, it's kind of like being a little kid when things change. I had deformities to my hands. I was 100% blind back then. Yeah. You know, there's no way I'm going to drive. I'm not the member of society that I used to be going back to work. So yeah, she had to sacrifice her career at the time and be my caretaker on top of being a mom. And, you know, you see stories on the news all the time, and you just know that a year from now, that couple's not going to be together anymore. I mean, marriage is hard enough between a man and a woman, let alone throw in some life-changing adversity. But when you stand up and say your vows, the for better or worse, sometimes the or worse part will come. And, you know, I give her a lot of credit for having the understanding that that's just the way it is. And, you know, today, if you were flying along my house, you'd never know anything life-changing took place. It's just very normal routine, raise a kid, do what you're supposed to do. And I give her all the respect and credit in the world for understanding that. And she has her new career now. She's a school teacher, and she's paying it forward to all the young minds out there, and it's been beautiful.
I think people need to know more about your eyes, because that is one of those things that you've come back from, but there's still work being done on your eyes.
The eyes will be a constant battle. I don't know really what the future holds. I was, you know, a lot of damage to the corneas, and I was completely blind for a long time. But the doctors, one eye doctor in particular here in the Valley, is just absolutely the best at what he does, Dr. Bill McLeish. And he got me to where I was back at work 18 months later, and I'm driving a car, I'm reading and writing reports on a computer, I'm investigating intricate homicide scenes. And, you know, I have issues with my eyes. I wear four contact lenses, two in each eye, soft lenses to protect my cornea, specially made hard lenses, so that I drove here today, I'm going to drive home. When I take those contacts out tonight, I don't see very well. And I showed up in his office last May, and he took me straight into surgery and sewed one of my eyes shut. He doesn't mess around when it comes to my eyesight. It was not a great day, but it took about a month. I healed from that, and I'm back to where I'm at today.
Have you been past the site of the accident? I mean, are there any memories, or is that just a spot now?
You know, it's funny. I drive through it quite a bit because it's right, you know, Central Phoenix, 20th Street and Thomas, and just on Monday, I was driving my son and three of his friends to a baseball game at St. Agnes, and we drove right through the intersection. And I thought, oh, nostalgia, I'll tell the story. And my son's real into it, my 11-year-old. And so I stopped the kids in the back seat, and I said, hey, guys. And I'm pointing to the lane I was sitting in and where I was hit, where the car stopped and on fire, where the fire truck was sitting. And, you know, they're 11. They were like, that's a great story. Can we go back to talking about what we were talking about? But I do drive through it, and it's never a bad memory. It's more of an interest because I was unconscious. Mm-hmm. And I like to try to picture what those firefighters were doing and how intense it must have been for them, the work and the bravery they showed, the two police officers on the scene that night. It's more of just a neat story for me as compared to any trepidation about being there.
Landon, finally, what are your hopes for the book? As you said, you've written 14 books now. You know, is there talk of a movie?
Let's not get carried away.
I think this would be an incredible movie. Actually, we're hoping Matthew McConaughey, fresh on the heels of his Dallas Buyers Club.
To anybody listening to this, Landon is a dreamer. So,
but Mark Twain said that fiction is stranger than truth, and Jason's story, you couldn't script it if you tried, and it almost seems implausible. Mm. And I think that's why it is so inspiring. There was such a chronology of events that had to happen for him to be sitting with us here 13 years later.
Jason, finally, any words of advice for those of us who whine about our sore backs or our sore throats or anything?
Well, I will tell you that whatever adversity you're facing, even if it's something as simple as your internet's not working today or your back hurts, I still get upset about those things. It's don't ever minimize it, and just try to remember that life is 10% what happens to you, 90% how you react to it. You can never let the pain of today blind you from the promise of tomorrow. This is a beautiful life, and just keep living it the best you can.
Jason Schachterly and Landon J. Napoleon. The new book is called Burning Shield. You can see them at Changing Hands Bookstore Friday night at 7. Guys, a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum, presenting Hollywood Costume. Nearly 100 years of costume design, featuring costumes from Marilyn Monroe to Dorothy's pinafore from The Wizard of Oz, now on view. phxart.org.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. It should be a partly cloudy day in the valley today. We're looking for a high of 83 degrees, and we may see some blowing dust this afternoon. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with an overnight low in the mid-50s. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Facebook is buying a virtual reality company for $2 billion as they work to turn social media into an interactive 3D experience. And a former U.S. ambassador to Russia is arguing for a tough response to that country's actions in Crimea. Here and Now starts at noon on 91.5. It's partly sunny in Phoenix right now, 16% relative humidity, and it's 78 degrees at 11:42.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Latin culture, that little extra roll of belly fat that many of us have is known as the panza. But in the Panza Monologues, co-creator Virginia Grice says the meaning goes far beyond the physical. She explores themes of humor, spirituality, and justice.
We were in San Antonio, and San Antonio at that point was the third largest city in the nation. And we mean that in terms of size, right? So we were ranked as the third most obese city in the nation. And both of us were doing activism work at a cultural center. And one of the things that we realized in looking at ourselves and looking around the table is we kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And really, the kind of conversations about the panza that happened around our organizing table became the basis for the work. And so we're Eve Ensler, in the Vagina Monologues, looks at a sort of large range of women and does these interviews kind of across the nation. One of the things that we asked ourselves is, what if we just looked at the women that were around our table? And we asked people to share stories. We shared our own stories. And so the stories that are inside of the text range from issues such as abortion to labor organizing to cultural differences, like what it means to go from San Antonio to Cuba, for example, and how people perceive body image and those types of things. And so at once it is a sort of reclamation of the body and being panza positive and feeling good about you, who you are. And at the same time, it's also a critique of what allows for certain conditions to exist. So why is diabetes a growing epidemic in the Latino community? You know, when I moved to San Antonio, I was a size 9. The largest I was in San Antonio in a period of 3 years was a size 24. And I really do believe that that has to do with access to food and who has the right to, you know, fresh vegetables and all of those types of questions.
So there are a lot of socioeconomic questions you're trying to address too, then.
Absolutely. You know, one of the pieces in the play is called The Panza is Political Panza. And that's one of our premises, is that the panza is political. And so if we begin to really look at how legislation and how, neighborhoods, the ways in which neighborhoods are segregated or not, how that affects our physical bodies, right, you begin to see just how political the panza is.
Do women have their own body image challenges or issues without even the involvement of men at all?
I think that they do, you know, and when you think about the panza, what's interesting about it, though, is that everybody has a panza, right? So whether you're flaca, whether you're skinny, whether you're male, whether you're female, whether you're transgendered, everybody's got a panza. And so because we looked at the people, you know, again, that were around our table, we were really looking at a sort of multi-generational group of Chicanas, Tejanas, and Mexicanas. And so in so many ways, it's very, very culturally specific to the women that we broke bread with on a daily basis for a number of years. We really are telling our stories. And the hope is that in telling our stories and the specificity of our stories, then people can make those connections. And so whether it's the man sitting in the audience or whether it's, you know, the skinny girl sitting in the audience or whoever else can begin to look at what were, at that moment, what were the most pressing issues for us? And in some cases, what were the more pressing issues? There's also moments that are really funny. And so, like, there's a piece that's called Panza Pliers that was written by Maria Salazar, which is about how do you get your jeans up when they don't quite fit, right? And so that's right next to the piece, you know, about labor organizing. And so it really is looking at the multifacetedness of women when they look at their bodies. They're not just talking about, and in fact, we actually don't have a single piece that addresses how other people are portraying us. But it's actually how we are portraying ourselves. And when you open up the space for us to tell our own stories, what are the stories that come to the forefront? And so that was actually, and even in just saying that, I just realized, wow, every single story is sort of from our perspective as opposed to how other people are portraying or looking at us.
You have a new edition of the Panza Monologues, which is, this is what, about a decade later?
Yes.
In the decade, what have you learned, whether it relates to the panza, whether it relates to yourself as an artist, as a performer? How much have you grown in that decade?
Well, it's really interesting to write a book 10 years later because you do learn that there's all sorts of things that have happened. And so when we set out to do that initial performance at Mox, we never thought that 10 years from now we'd still be talking about our panzas. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing how relevant the stories still are. But there's also, you know, as we started going back, one of the things that we also were surprised about is that we never expected for other people to pick up the stories, uh-huh, and to pick up the play and to start performing them. And that's one of the things that's really happening now, is that especially a lot of college age students across the country are beginning to do the Panza Monologues. And that was not something that we had foreseen.
Virginia Grice is co-creator of the Panza Monologues. Virginia, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Perhaps if our government instituted Panza positive policies, we might have world peace. Because we can see our humanity by the well-being of all our panzas. So don't be afraid of what we have to do, because we are the panza. And to claim the panza is to be free.
You can hear more of Virginia Grice reading from the Panza Monologues tonight at 7 at the Herberger Theater Center in downtown Phoenix.
Very large mouth.
Very aggressive. Pads of teeth.
Huge mouth.
Whoa, that's a big fish.
This is the largest eel.
Oh, I can feel her pulling on the net. It's a bigger fish.
Oh,
I can't even lift it. The monster, it's a hog.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Taking photos and shooting video for National Geographic is starkly different from what the rest of us may try on weekends. Brian Smith is an award-winning filmmaker for the National Geographic Channel who recently directed The Man Who Could Fly, special on experiments in human-powered flight. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. His presentation is called The Lens of Adventure. Brian, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the monster fish, what is that about? That's a little clip we just heard.
Yeah, that's a series with host Zeb Hogan that I've done a ton of work on. And Zeb, you know, basically travels the world looking for the biggest freshwater fish that exist.
What's that like for you?
It's interesting to work on a fishing show because you're working with nature and kind of hoping for the big fish all the time, but never knowing exactly when it's going to happen. So it really keeps you on your toes.
How does that fit into what you describe as your career arc as a filmmaker?
Well, I think, you know, I sort of specialized a lot in adventure stuff for a long time. In adventure, we have to go, you know, sort of difficult places. Mm-hmm. So at National Geographic, you know, if there isn't adventure, some kind of a remote exploration requires the same set of skills. You have to be willing to, you know, work outside for long hours. You have to be able to manage media, charge batteries, just operate in difficult locations.
Do you get yourself psyched up for that? I know some people are characterized as adrenaline junkies. Some people just, hey, it's part of the job. I'm going to go do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the anxiety is always at the beginning of those trips, getting ready. It's interesting because people always ask, like, well, aren't you scared? Aren't you nervous when you're there? And it's usually the lead up that's a little more scary. Like, once you drop in and once you're in the field, you just do your work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would never say that I don't, you know, go through some amount of fear or being scared. I think that's the natural part of preparing for those missions.
You've been to some pretty exotic places. I wonder if you could tell us about the last couple of places you've been. There was one for National Geographic and one not.
Yeah, recently for National Geographic, I was in Turkmenistan, which is a country that's bordered by Afghanistan and Iran in the Middle East. It's actually quite safe.
There's really nothing going on there lately. So
yeah. I mean, the country itself doesn't have like huge terrorism problems or lots of stuff on the go. So that's what instantly people think about. But it's a fascinating country because they basically box themselves, you know, away from the outside world. They haven't let people in. It's the second hardest country in the world to get cameras into. So we were there doing a show that's going to air on National Geographic for part of a series called Die Trying that's coming in a couple months from now.
Okay. Wow. But I mean, so what goes into, if it's a place that doesn't really like cameras in, what was the process behind getting that? How long a process? How much did the name National Geographic mean there?
Yeah, I wasn't myself personally super involved with the process, but I think the team at National Geographic working with the U.S. Embassy certainly, you know, used and leveraged the credibility of National Geographic as a reason for why they should be the first, you know, crew to get in there with cameras.
Yeah. Where did your love of cameras, of photography, of filmmaking come from?
Well, my dad was a photographer as a hobby. So I grew up, you know, with a darkroom always around. I was totally fascinated by the darkroom as a kid. Just like the idea that you go in and work in somewhere, but you can't turn on the lights except for the red one, you know. I don't know whether that triggered it or not, but as a kid, I had that experience. But I think my real passion for it came from going into these places, paddling rivers and going into these deep gorges and realizing that no one was seeing them. And so, you know, that was where I started filming, was I thought, there's places and stories to be told, and I need to pick up a camera and start capturing this.
Well, you have a lot of water experience. I mean, you're very good at that. So was that learned behavior? Was that something you knew early on you wanted to do?
I mean, I grew again. You know, I can look back to the roots in my childhood. I grew up on Lake Michigan on the water. Obviously, there was, you know, water around me all the time. So maybe that had an impact. But I didn't really start kayaking. That was my first real water sport until college. And I loved the sport and I loved where it took me. And I realized that it was an easy vehicle for filmmaking because it was a skill that other people didn't have.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. I'm talking with Brian Smith. He'll be at the Mesa Arts Center tonight. It's part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. His presentation is called The Lens of Adventure. Brian, this is probably really hard to characterize, but what's the most important film you've shot? What are some of the most important photos you've shot based on where you've been?
Yeah, I think one trip that comes to mind that I'll talk about tonight is when I went to Kamchatka in 2011. We did a show, a monster fish show, but we were also exploring previously unexplored rivers. And the story we wanted to tell was about how the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia is the most critical salmon habitat in the world. It's where a third to a quarter of the world's wild salmon population exists, and it's under threat. And so it was a conservation story. And so a lot of times when I look at what we do, sometimes the story is about the adventure, about the exploration. And for me, Kamchatka was much more than that. It was about exploring a place, but it was also about trying to expose a bigger story.
What about the film, The Man Who Could Fly? This is what fascinates me about this is, what did you learn about human behavior from this kind of thing? Like, what makes us want to do this? I mean, I'll see something. You see people cliff diving, which even I don't think I'd have the guts even to do that. But you watch, and it must feel so good. What did you learn about folks doing that in The Man Who Could Fly?
Well, I think a lot of humans have a real fascination with pushing the line of what they can and can't do. What is possible? You know, like, what can we do? And some people sit back and they don't really like to push that line, and other people really are at the forefront of pushing that line of you know, what's possible. And The Man Who Could Fly is a great story of that. I mean, Dean Potter is one of the adventure world's, you know, greatest athletes. And he has a mental capacity and mindset to go places where probably a lot of people don't want to go. And so what I learned about that is sometimes what you think is completely impossible is actually very possible. And what from the outside looks like, you know, extreme risk-taking is actually very calculated. And someone spends a lot of time thinking about that and pushing it forward. I think that's the biggest thing is really where is that line, and how do you define that line in pushing the limits of what's possible?
Brian, finally, what does that mean for what you do? When you're not in an exotic locale here, you're in a studio, you'll be at the Mesa Arts Center tonight. Does it feel sort of mundane?
No, I mean, you know, tonight's really interesting because it's a live show. And I actually think what I do in the field is very similar to, you know, like what you might do on the radio or, you know, presenting tonight where you're live and you have to, you know, you kind of want to hit your marks and you want to make sure you do things correctly. For me, this experience is an opportunity to share stories that people otherwise wouldn't hear. You know, a lot of people don't think about it, but when they watch that crazy show on National Geographic, there's actually a camera team behind everything that's going on making the film.
Filmmaker Brian Smith will be at the Mesa Arts Center tonight at 7:30 as part of the National Geographic Live Speakers Series. Brian, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. A familiar Central Phoenix landmark will close its doors for good sometime today. Karsh's Bakery, which started on Central Avenue in the 60s before moving in 1985, was considered the place to get kosher goods. But increased competition, mostly from supermarkets, is leading to the end of Karsh's. Longtime Phoenician and former Arizona Regional Director for the Anti-Defamation League, Bill Strauss, says he did not see it coming.
It was a surprise, but I've seen so many of that kind of almost bigger than life business close in Phoenix. And it's very sad. I don't know if you remember Ence White.
I do, yeah.
Ence White was one of those stores I thought would never, ever close. But we had Tang's Market, my parents' stores, Leonard's, lots of institutions, retail institutions that have gone by the wayside. And it's sad.
So where does Karsh's fit in as far as Jewish culture goes in Phoenix?
I don't think I went to a Jewish event when I was younger that Karsh's wasn't represented at.
No.
Whether it was from bar mitzvahs to namings to sitting shiva for someone who had recently died. It didn't matter what. Always a pink box. Yeah, and Karsh's was always there.
Considering what a large city Phoenix is and how big the valley has gotten, how important is it to have a Greek bakery, an Italian bakery, a Jewish bakery, these types of places represented in a city of this size?
I really value anything that allows people to connect to their roots. You know, I've been confronted a lot of times with people who are very offended by people who label themselves. They self-identify as hyphenated Americans, whether it's African-Americans, Japanese-Americans, Italian-Americans. I've always kind of liked that. And I think it's really important to facilitate somebody connecting or in many cases, reconnecting to that part of their culture, their history, their people that is important. And certainly in almost every culture, I think food plays a really, really important role. And people have really good reflections and memories about food connected with their particular culture.
Bill Strauss, former Arizona Regional Director for the Anti-Defamation League, talking about the demise of Karsh's Bakery, a longtime Phoenix staple. That's it for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg and Sarah Ventry for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to hear this program again or any of our past editions, you can go online this afternoon to kjzz.org or download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now we head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.